This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Hey, y'all. I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. All right, welcome back to your weekly dose of Monstrous.
Weekly dose of us.
Right. So today is obviously Monday, and the date when you are hearing this is December 22nd, 2025.
The heartbreak this year is almost over.
I know. 3 days from the day that this airs, because we're recording ahead, Logan will be 12.
Stop it!
Can you believe that?
No.
I know.
It's just, my mind is wrapping around all this.
I know. You're telling me.
You're mom. I'm grandma.
Oh. Okay. Anyway. So by now, the days are short. The air is freezing.
To put it kindly.
Right. At least here where we're at. Freezing cold. Ooh. And in just a few short days, obviously, the world will be celebrating Christmas. But today, we are not celebrating that it is Christmas. Instead, we're delving into a story where the season of joy was violently consumed by tragedy, suspicion, and a mystery that burns today just as hot as it did 80 years ago.
Dang, I wasn't even born then.
Nope.
Yeah, that chair don't roll real good on carpet.
No. Situate myself. Okay. To get comfy.
I'm a red comfy girl.
I know, and that big old chair you got.
That I'm going to be paying for.
Right. Okay. Sorry, guys. All right, so picture this. It's Christmas Eve, 1945. And we're in the quiet mining town of Fayetteville, West Virginia.
I didn't know there was a Fayetteville, West Virginia. Learn something new every day. I knew there was one in North Carolina.
So the Second World War is finally over, and America is breathing a collective sigh of relief, preparing for their first peaceful holiday season in years. The air was thick with cold and the promise of snow, but inside the home, the mood was bright, lights were strong, and anticipation hung heavy for the morning to follow. But for one family, the Sodders, that peace would be shattered by a sequence of events so precise, so devastatingly effective, that it defies every logical conclusion of accident or simple tragedy. Their story is a stark reminder that sometimes the darkness doesn't wait for the new year. Sometimes it arrives precisely when the light is supposed to be the brightest. This is not a story about a fire that may... This is not... I paused at the wrong time. This is not a story about a fire that merely claimed lives. This is the story about a fire that made 5 children vanish, leaving behind absolutely no trace. Local authorities were quick to rule it an accident, claiming the intense heat had consumed the bodies entirely. But this claim became impossible when, years later, the parents unearthed 4 small pieces of human vertebrae from the ashes. Scientific analysis proved 2 things. The bones showed no fire damage whatsoever, and they belonged to an adult, not a child.
Oh.
This simple, impossible piece of evidence exposes a deep, unsettling current of prejudice, cover-up, and organized malice in a small American town. The mystery boils down to 1 simple, terrifying question. Were the Sauter children killed in the fire? Or were they secretly kidnapped and spirited away by people who wanted to silence their immigrant father? In order to understand the disappearance of the Sauter children and why this is the question, we have to understand the family's backgrounds, the precise threats they received, and the impossible series of mechanical failures and procedural errors that conspired to ensure no one could save the children or even find their remains. So now the physical fire only lasted a single night, but the emotional fire of doubt, suspicion, and unresolved grief has been burning for 80 years. But before we delve into the details of a Christmas Eve tragedy that defies all explanation, let's take a moment to reflect on the 9 souls that we examined last week that were lost in the icy wilderness of the Ural Mountains. The Dyatlov Pass incident is a chilling reminder of how nature, or a force that we still don't understand, can turn a planned expedition into an inexplicable massacre. Last week, we discussed those 9 experienced hikers who fled their tent in sub-zero temperatures, many dying of hypothermia, but 3 had sustained catastrophic non-human impact injuries, which included crushed ribs, a fractured skull, and even a missing tongue and eyes. It was a compelling natural force, so the Soviets concluded. But what force could compel a group to tear open their tent and run barefoot into the dark?
The bumble.
The mystery remains frozen in time, much like the tragic events that we are about to explore, proving that sometimes the most horrific stories are those that offer no answers at all. And if the Dyatlov Pass case is a chilling portrait of people who couldn't escape an unknown force, then the Sauter story is a horrific example of a family who did escape the flames, only to be left with a lifetime of burning questions. Like I said, to understand this vanishing, we must first understand the family at its center, the Sauters of Fayetteville, West Virginia. So it was 1945. World War II was finally over, and America was finally going to have a peaceful Christmas. The patriarch of the Sauter family was George Sauter. He was born in Giorgio, I think that's how you say it, Soldu in Tola, Sardinia. So he was an immigrant. His story is one of sheer relentless independence. So we're going to spend a minute on George because his character is a frictional point for this entire thing. George came to the U.S. as a young man at only 13, and he worked alone on the railroad before moving to West Virginia. He didn't just survive here in the U.S. He excelled and he thrived. He built a highly successful local trucking company, establishing himself as a fixture of wealth and success in a very small town. But he carried with him those strong opinions of his homeland, particularly his passionate hatred for the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini.
Mussolini was an ant.
Mm-hmm, and he did not like him, as many immigrants.
Most people in general didn't like Mussolini.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't know anything about him.
Yeah.
I don't know nothing about
him. He was a real jerk.
Was he? So George was not quiet about his hatred.
I kept it clean because I could say other things.
He was outspoken and he shared his views widely, a stance that made him successful, but also conspicuous in the tight-knit community that he lived in. This self-made wealth and his political opinions created the kind of power targets that would attract attention and ultimately danger. Can I say something? So he and his wife, the meticulous Jeannie Sauter, had 10 children.
No, thank you.
That's what I'm saying.
Who's enough? So two, sometimes it's too many.
Right. No, thank you. So one son, the eldest, Joe, was away in the military at the time of the event. Or he was the second eldest, I'm sorry. So that left 9 children home with George and Jeannie the night of Christmas Eve. The 4 children who were able to escape the fire with George and Jenny were Marion, who was 17, John, the eldest, at 23 years old, George Jr., who was 16, and Sylvia, who was only 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The 5 children who vanished and whose bodies were never recovered were 14-year-old Maurice, Martha, who was 12 years old, 9-year-old Louis, 8-year-old Jenny, and Betty at only 5 years old.
Little.
Yep. George's anti-Mussolini fervor provided the first chilling cracks in the family's foundations. So in the months leading up to December in 1945.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The Real Real.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The Real Real, game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The Real Real than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The Real Real. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
There were 2 specific undeniable threats. First was a life insurance salesman who came to their home. And when George refused his business, the salesman threatened him directly, saying, quote, "Your house is going to go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed. You will pay for your dirty remarks about Mussolini."
What has that got to do with life insurance?
No idea. But I think the salesman got mad because George was like, "No, thank you. You know, we don't need life insurance." And so because he already didn't like George, then him refusing to purchase life insurance from him, that was his reaction, I think, is probably how that went down.
Some people, I tell you.
Right. So the second one was when Jenny noticed a strange man in her yard checking the fuse boxes and this man had claimed the house's wiring was faulty, which George immediately dismissed as faulty. He's like, "No, it's not faulty. Go the fuck away." But in 1945, Tom. So these 2 incidences had come, like I said, just weeks before the most horrific night of their lives. And it painted a very disturbing picture after the fact. So the man who had made that prophetic threat, the insurance salesman, was not a stranger to the investigation after the fire took place. He served as the foreman for the coroner's jury. And that coroner's jury swiftly ruled the children's deaths as accidental due to faulty wiring.
A little suspicious.
Mm-hmm. A little sus. So this was a profound conflict of interest, clearly, that would permanently taint the official findings and immediately fuel George's mistrust of the local authorities. Which, I mean, you can't really...
I don't blame him.
Right. So this brings us to the pivotal evening of December 24th, 1945. So we're going to slow it down a little bit so that way we can feel what is happening. Okay. So the night began innocently. At 10 p.m., George and Jenny said their goodnights. And in a final tragic act of kindness, the older children, after George and Jenny had went to bed, which was Marion and George Jr., gave up their downstairs bedroom to the younger boys, Maurice and Louis, so that way they could sleep near the warmth of the stove. Because normally the 2 older ones slept downstairs. But they decided, "Oh, it's really cold. So we're going to go upstairs so the little ones can sleep near the stove and be warm.
That makes sense.
So Marion had stayed up just a little bit later with the younger kids to play games, open a few, you know, small early Christmas presents, you know, all the things that most families do Christmas Eve. They switched rooms, all went to bed. That shift in the sleeping arrangements, driven by, you know, the simple sibling goodwill of wanting their youngest siblings to stay warm, meant that the five missing children were all concentrated to the attic bedrooms, which is far from an easy escape route. This was a seemingly innocent choice that tragically amplified their vulnerability to the planned sabotage that had took place below them. So the first disruption was at 12:30 a.m. when the telephone rang. Jenny went downstairs and she answered it. A female voice was on the line and asked for a name that Jenny didn't recognize. Then she heard some, you know, some laughter, clinking of glasses in the background. She figured it was just a wrong number. Before returning to bed, Jenny then noticed something very unusual. The living room lights were still on, the shades were still up, and the doors were unlocked, which to her meant that Marion had not properly secured the house, which is a crucial detail for the theories that have come of an external entry into the home. So while Jenny believed that the call was a staged distraction, that's what she thinks, that someone purposely called to distract her so someone could get into the home. Which doesn't really make any sense because her and George were already in bed, so why would you need to make the phone call?
Well, they didn't know that.
That's true. That's true. Maybe they thought the kids were still up or something. So even though she believed this, the police, on the other hand, officially claimed that they had identified the caller as one of the local neighbors who admitted that she had been at a party drinking and accidentally misdialed.
And that very well could have happened.
And at first, that's what Jenny thought when she first took the call. But after the fact, she then, you know, believed, oh, it was a distraction. So the Sodders, however, completely dismissed that explanation. They did not take what the police were saying to heart for anything. This only deepened their belief in a coordinated plot against them. So just a half hour later, at 1 o'clock a.m., Jenny had settled back to sleep when she heard a second, far more ominous noise. A thud on their roof, followed by a rolling noise. So as if someone had thrown something on their roof and it rolled down.
It's Santa Claus. He did too much eggnog.
So this sound is linked to George's later discovery in the yard of a small, dark green, hard rubber object resembling a pineapple. Experts later believe that this object was a modified thermite-style incendiary, sometimes called a pineapple bomb. So this is a crude device designed not just to start a fire, but to quickly intensify it, creating a rapid, suffocating chaos meant to hinder any immediate rescue attempt, which then furthers the theory of a professional organized hit.
Wow.
Yeah. So thermite, okay, for anyone that does not know, is a compound used in these devices. It is a pyrotechnic combination of metal powder and metal oxide.
Let's just blow up the neighbors.
Mm-hmm. So unlike traditional accelerants like gas or, you know, some type of alcohol, it creates an exothermic reaction that generates immense heat. And this heat often reaches temperatures well over 4,000 degrees in Fahrenheit.
Be warm.
Yeah, like you're not surviving through that.
You're gonna get toasted.
Right. So this is critical because it doesn't just burn. It melts and cuts through steel and wood structures instantly.
Dang.
Yeah. So this explains the fire's unprecedented speed and the intensity around the electric box and the staircase. So the use of such a device confirms the attackers prioritized instantaneous, overwhelming destruction for a slow and subtle blaze. So they wanted the house gone as fast as possible.
No shit.
Yeah. So analysis of all of this would later confirm that the device was a spent military incendiary, a key factual point contradicting the faulty wiring theory. Because if it was faulty wiring, why would a spent military incendiary known as a pineapple, known as a pineapple bomb, be found outside the home? Doesn't make any sense. Can't be faulty wiring, my guys. So immediately following
that, with that thing, there would be no wires.
Right, exactly. Like, how could it be fault? Like, it just makes no sense. So immediately following that thud, Jenny smelled smoke. She woke George, and they quickly located the source of the fire. Flames were rapidly spreading around the telephone line and the circuit box in George's office, right near the single wooden stairwell to the attic. So this fire was intentionally set here. As the fire took hold, the sounds would become terrifying. The rapid, wet crackle of the wooden frame contrasted with the horrifying thick smoke that would have immediately filled the chimney-like stairwell, providing virtually no chance of survival. George immediately shouted upstairs to wake the children. Now, adding to this architectural context of this disaster, the fire was concentrated around the chimney in the flue pipe area.
That looked like a fire from the chimney.
But they didn't have a chimney from what I could see. They had like a wood burning stove.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So there would have been like a pipe to go out of the house, but not like, remember the older kids went upstairs. So the younger kids could sleep downstairs to stay warm. So
right.
That stove wasn't near the stairs. So the stove couldn't have caused the fire there. Because those wood stoves get hot.
Yeah, they do.
And if the wood stove would have been near the stairs, it would have heated the upstairs.
Yeah, why should it be heated the upstairs anyway? Because heat rises.
Well, but I mean, it would have heated it as if they were right there. Because that pipe would have went directly through the attic
to
get outside.
And the pipe would get hot.
Exactly. So they wouldn't have had to switch rooms. Clearly, that's not how it was, because they traded rooms so the younger kids could be warmer than if they would have been upstairs. So the stove couldn't have caused the fire. Not only that, how did the circuit box catch fire if it was from a stove?
True.
And what about George's office? Why are the phone lines on fire? His phone lines are outside the house, not inside the house.
Yeah, especially back in those days.
Mm-hmm. So it couldn't have been from the stove. All things you just don't think of. Oh, I just did that. Okay. So this was the very location that Jenny would later have claimed was the single structural point where human remains should have been concentrated had the children perished. Right? Because they were upstairs. That's the area that their remains should have been found in. Because if it would have caught fire, everything's going to fall straight down.
Yeah.
It's not going to, you know what I mean? The fire would not have been hot enough to fully consume the bones. Not that quickly.
Mm-mm.
Because even though those temperatures can reach 4,000 degrees.
It still takes time.
Right. Human bones don't just go up in ash. In a matter of a few seconds. Yes, the skin would, but the bones would still be there. There would be fire damage to the bones. It would be very clear that they were in a fire. But they would still be there. There would be evidence of human remains there from the very beginning.
Because it takes 2 to 4 hours for flame-based method, depending on the body size and equipment, to cremate a body.
And these are children, so it would have taken at least 2 hours.
2 to 3 hours for the average adult.
Yeah, so it would have taken probably about 30 minutes to an hour roughly for children. But these were also older children. But yeah. Either way, it would have taken at least minimum an hour.
said it could take anywhere from 30 minutes for like a stillborn, maybe to over 4 hours for larger and a larger adult.
And being children, it would have taken at least an hour, at least.
Yeah.
The fire didn't burn for an hour. It was out very quickly, which I mentioned that later, but the fire didn't burn long enough to destroy the bone. Didn't happen. So this is the most chilling and damning detail of this entire evening. Okay, I haven't told you this part.
I'm listening.
The five children in the attic never screamed, cried, or made any sound at all.
Those children weren't in that attic.
Because even before they knew the fire was happening, the smoke would have got up to them. The smoke would have choked them and the smoke would have woke them up.
Yep.
This silence is difficult to reconcile with a raging fire directly below their only exit. So this is essential when it comes to what happened to the children. Because no one not wakes up during a fire unless you're incapacitated for some reason. But these are children. If they weren't incapacitated, they would have woken up.
Yeah.
Especially there being wiring and all of this.
Unless the smoke got to them first.
Yeah, but they would have woke up from the, because it would have been because there was telephone wires and all of that being burnt. That would have caused them to cough way more than just a regular house fire. At least one of them would have woken up. Because there were five children upstairs. At least one of those five kids would have woke up. Had they been upstairs. At least one of them would have woke up.
Those children were there.
I don't think so. But we'll get into that. Okay. So now John initially told the police that he had woken the children. But he later retracted this statement, suggesting that he had maybe only yelled at the door to, like, wake them up, which that's probably what happened, because, I mean, there's a fire there. And, yeah, he's going to change it later, because in the initial aftermath, they're shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked they just,
to begin with.
Right, and they just escaped a massive fire. His siblings are missing. You know what I mean? So that I can, that's easy to just dismiss. So the fact that five children aged 5 to 14 failed to make any sound during a rapidly spreading fire is the strongest circumstantial evidence that they were either drugged, choked, rendered unconscious, or removed from the home before the fire was ever set. So George Denny and four of the other children, like I said, successfully escaped out the back door and through a window. Once outside, that's when they realized that the five children in the attic had not gotten out. Because they obviously couldn't get upstairs to them. So they thought they had woken up and maybe gotten out the window for the upstairs. They got outside. That's when they realized they weren't there. The sequence of failed rescues that followed transforms the fire from a simple tragedy into a possible crime scene. The single staircase to the attic was immediately engulfed in flames. George, realizing the severity, ran to his rain barrel, but it was empty. There was nothing in it, so he couldn't even attempt to put the fire out. Then he ran to the side of the house where he kept a large 20-foot aluminum ladder. It was always there, but the ladder was gone. It was later found tossed into a 70-foot embankment, the first, strongest, and most undeniable indicator of premeditation for this. And the ladder was not simply moved. It was forcefully dragged and thrown that 70-foot distance downhill, which would require a considerable physical effort and a deliberate commitment to obstructing the rescue. So the fact that the saboteurs knew precisely where the 20-foot ladder was kept and took the time to disable it before setting the fire points to an immediate knowledge of the solder property and a cold step-by-step plan to ensure the victims were trapped inside.
Yeah, but why would somebody kill children?
I don't know. But see, my thought is, I don't think the goal was to kill them. I really don't. We'll get into it. We'll get into it. Let's get through it, and then we'll get into it. And I'll tell you what I think. So George Barefoot, in the freezing air, attempted a desperate, immediate entry by smashing a downstairs window with his bare hand, badly cutting his arm in the process of doing this. Which, yeah, of course, in that moment, I don't give a fuck.
Right.
He was quickly repelled, though, by the overwhelming smoke and heat that now swept through the entire first floor. So he can't even get through the window to try to get upstairs. So this act of immediate physical sacrifice underscores the chaotic reality of this fire. The speed with which it spread meant that even direct, painful intervention was impossible. So even if he had been able to get into that house, the downstairs was completely engulfed. There was no way he was going to get through that house.
Right.
George, desperate, offered money to members of the large crowd that had began to gather, begging anyone to help him reach the upstairs windows. But with the windows too high and no way to reach them, George made his final, most desperate move. He ran to his two large, heavy-duty coal trucks, intending to use them as platforms. Crucially, though, both of his trucks, which had been running perfectly fine the day before, didn't start. Either one of them. His oldest son, John, after many failed attempts, had finally managed to get his own work truck to start. But sadly, it would not start until after the fire had completely burned out. So when John ran into town after realizing that, you know, his truck wasn't going to start, he ran to town for help. And he tried to use the local fire alarm system, which is a large central whistle. But he found that it wasn't working either.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Right. He was then forced to run to the fire chief's home instead. Now, the combination between, which I haven't told you this, the cut phone lines, so they couldn't even call. The dysfunctional town alarm system ensured an almost insurmountable delay. Okay. So, like I said, the fire did not burn for 2-3 hours, nothing like that. It lit up and it was out pretty quickly. But it burned itself out. It was not put out.
Dang.
Despite, I mean, because it's cold, fire doesn't burn as long when it's cold. There's less oxygen getting to it, you know, all those things.
Yeah.
Okay. You were looking at me like you had no idea what I was
talking about. No, I was listening.
So despite the fire only being 2 miles away from the Fayetteville Fire Department, they did not arrive to the scene until 8 a.m.
Talk about taking your sweet ass time.
Nearly 7 hours after the fire had started. By that time, the fire had completely burnt the house down to its foundation, leaving only a basement full of glowing ashes behind.
Dang, they lost everything.
Mm-hmm. This extreme delay, whether due to incompetence or malice, guaranteed the destruction of any remaining evidence. The 5 children trapped inside were gone.
I couldn't imagine what the mother's going through.
Now, the next morning, Christmas Day.
Yay.
The tragedy exploded into a public spectacle and a catastrophic failure of investigation. The crowd that gathered was enormous. A chaotic mix of neighbors, rubberneckers, and local officials all trampling the scene. That's like the staple of crime scenes in the 40s.
Yeah.
Let's just let everybody in here and get a peek of what's happening. So this initial chaos allowed local officials to quickly seize control and push a narrative. Fire Chief F.J. Morris conducted a rapid, cursory search, concluding that the fire had been hot enough to completely incinerate the bodies. But there's no record that I could find that says how hot the fire was. Those pineapple bombs can get up to 4,000 degrees, but There's nothing that I could find that said how hot this fire got. Because how hot a fire gets depends on a lot of things.
Yeah. Fuel.
Mm-hmm. So it's like, and it's wintertime too. I don't see if I mean, I could be wrong. I'm not a fire expert, but I don't see a house fire getting to 4,000 degrees in the winter.
Oh, it could, honey. I mean, if it feels right.
That's why I said I could be wrong. I don't know. It just sounds weird to me. So this narrative was cemented just 5 days later with a shocking act of legal expediency. So only 5 days later, they conducted a coroner's jury, which was led by that hostile insurance man. And they issued 5 death certificates for all 5 of the missing children, listing the cause of death and reason for the fire as faulty wiring. All without any proof that the 5 children were deceased. Crucially, while analyzing potential motive, George reportedly allowed his fire insurance policy to lapse shortly before the fire. A detail that both suggests financial carelessness, but also undercuts any theories that have emerged that he set the fire for insurance money. Which, like I said, we're going to get into those. But, I mean, there was no fire insurance on the house, so why would he set the fire himself? So this rapid closure was the ultimate legal injustice for this case. By officially declaring the children dead and the case closed, the local government was absolving itself of any further responsibility for any kind of investigation, effectively turning the Sauders' pursuit of truth into a private uphill battle. So they're like, no, we're not even going to look into this. There's
we're
no
tired. I'm over it.
Yeah. We're good. It was a house fire. There's no remains. The fire was hot enough to get rid of the bone. Don't know what to tell you. That's basically what they said. Yeah. But George and Jenny Sauder immediately refused to accept this official tragedy theory. They did not believe for a second what they were saying happened is what happened. And with that, we need to analyze why their rejection was scientifically sound. Because there's some things here to back it up. First, Jenny, being meticulous, conducted her own experiment, proving that charred bones always remained after burning meat and bones. And the Sauders found nothing. There were no ashes. Nothing. So we must reiterate that forensic experts agree that a typical house fire cannot destroy the human skeleton. And so the lack of any bone fragments was scientifically impossible here, suggesting that the children were never in that attic. Second, we have the faulty wiring cause that was then discredited because the Christmas lights on the exterior of the house, they remained on during the initial stages of the fire.
And if it had been faulty wiring, there'd have been no electricity anywhere in that house.
Yep.
Even this old dumb white woman knows that.
Oh my God. So it couldn't have been faulty wiring, but that's what they ruled it as. Now, obviously, after the fact, there were no Christmas lights. Obviously. But when the fire first started, all of their electricity worked.
Yeah.
Faulty wiring would have taken the electricity out completely.
Immediately.
Yeah.
In fact, that would have been the first thing to go.
Right. So experts note that fire caused by an internal electrical fault leaves specific arcing patterns on the wire insulation. The flames that the solder saw were starting externally at the junction box. A clear sign of an external accelerant or incendiary device. The fire started externally, not internally. Had it been faulty wiring, it would have started internally.
It'd been in the wall.
Right. Third, and the final nail in the arson conclusion, a phone company repairman later told the Sauders that the line to their house had not been burned through, but had actually been cut cleanly 15 feet up from the ground.
Dang.
Mm-hmm. Reports suggest that this coat was made with professional tools, such as tree climbing spikes, indicating a highly deliberate and specialized effort to ensure they couldn't call anyone. So compounding the failures, Fire Chief F.J. Morris's misconduct escalated the situation. It highlighted a possible cover-up culture with the local officials. He was reported to have told someone else that he found a human heart in the rubble, but decided to bury it quietly for, quote, closure.
That heart wouldn't have been in the rubble.
No, it wouldn't have.
It'd have been petrified.
Right, sir, sir, sir. We need to have a talk, okay? If the bones were incinerated, the heart would have been incinerated as well. You wouldn't have been able to bury it.
It'd have been added with the other ashes.
Right.
Even I know that.
That makes no sense. You need to go back to school, sir. Now, when the Sodders heard this, they forced Morris to show them the burial spot, which led to the discovery of the infamous beef liver, not a heart, bolstering the local cover-up and misconduct theory.
No shit.
So this fucking jackwad decided, let me go buy a beef liver, bury it, and then tell everybody I found a heart. The fuck is wrong with you? And this is the fire chief?
He been to too many fires. That fried his brain.
But what? No, thank you. Like, go away. Okay? I'll take care of the fire myself.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. So pathologists later examined this buried organ and identified it as a large intact piece of beef liver, like I said. Yeah. It's not even a human organ. Look. So the fact that the local fire chief Morris attempted to pass this off as a human organ and secretly bury it to achieve what he called closure was a brazen act of calculated misconduct that completely shattered the family's remaining trust in their local governance and fueled their unwavering belief in a massive local cover-up.
No shit.
Right. As evidence of the immediate chaos, a bus driver who passed the site claimed to have seen a man pulling a bloody body bag or object from the fire site and then transferring it into a car. Which that one was weird to me, but I mean, you know, I had to include it because it was reported on. But that one's weird. Like, what would he have pulled? There was nothing left of the house. So that doesn't really make any sense, but do with it what you will. Other witnesses speculatively claimed, okay, these are all speculative, claimed that they saw a dark-colored sedan parked near the house around 2 a.m., which was shortly before the fire began. So this sedan was speculatively reported to have been driven by a man known locally to collect outstanding debts and was rumored to be connected to the anti-Mussolini tensions that George had stirred up. So there's that. So this alleged sighting of a coordinated professional exit from the scene moments after the fire started to cement the local fear that this was not an accident at all, but a highly effective planned extraction of the children.
But why take the children?
Teach him a lesson?
They should have just took him. He's the one mouthing off about Mussolini.
Yeah, but in this entire world, everything in the world, what is your most valuable thing?
My grandchildren.
Exactly. He's their father. His house isn't going to matter. His life isn't going to matter. His children's lives are more valuable than anything.
That's true.
You take the thing that is most valuable. So additionally, a woman named Ida Crutchfield, who ran a Charleston hotel, had claimed that she saw the children a week later at her hotel accompanied by people of Italian descent. Mm-hmm. So these multiple consented sightings fueled the kidnapping narrative from day one. Now, distraught, George Sauter committed a catastrophic error. Days after the fire, and against the advice of the fire marshal, George used a bulldozer to plow the rubble into the basement and cover the site with dirt, destroying the crime scene forever.
I can understand why he did that, though.
Right. I mean, and what fucking evidence were they going to get?
None, because the fire destroyed it all.
Right. It's all gone.
So, there's nothing there.
I mean, what? How are you going to see if it actually was arson? There's no way to. It's gone. So I can't really blame him for doing that.
And back in those days, they didn't have the brick and mortar, like a lot, you know, like mm-hmm. we have the stucco and all that. It was all wood.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So compounding this self-inflicted forensic catastrophe was the nature of the house's construction. So the basement where the furnace was located was built with a thick concrete floor, so like ours is.
Right.
Fire experts agree that any human remains, even if the victims did perish in the attic, would have eventually collapsed onto that concrete slab and would have been partially protected from the highest temperatures by the debris, making the total absence of remains scientifically impossible. There would have been something left behind, even if it did get hot enough to incinerate bone in that short amount of time. Something would have been left behind.
The teeth don't burn.
They would have found some kind of evidence of them, and they found nothing. The only way that the bodies could vanish entirely is if they simply weren't there when the fire reached its peak.
I don't think they were there.
A point that George's bulldozing inadvertently buried, but did not erase.
Oh.
Yet the family pressed on. Their public campaign would last decades. For years, the family maintained a large, brightly colored billboard on Route 16, the major highway that runs through Fayetteville. This billboard became the face of the tragedy for the nation. It displayed large, hopeful photos of the five missing children, listing their names and ages, and offered a substantial reward that was continuously updated and increased over time.
Damn.
The Sauters poured their resources into physically maintaining that sign, year after year, refusing to let the public forget their missing children. They wrote to the FBI in 1947, only to be rebuffed by J. Edgar Hoover, who declared the case to be a local matter. However, George Sauter's relentless public campaign, fueled by an estimated personal cost of over $40,000 in the 1950s, which today would be around $537,000,
mm-hmm.
closer to $538,000. This campaign eventually forced the FBI to take a minor reluctant role later in the 50s. Ultimately, the agents concluded what the local police did, that the children likely perished in the fire. This was a final official non-finding that underscored the bureaucratic failure in this case. Now, going back to 1949, before the FBI's review, George and Jenny had excavated the site themselves, and they found four small pieces of human vertebrae. These were sent to the Smithsonian Institution, where pathologists had two major explosive findings. First, the bones showed absolutely no signs of fire damage. And secondly, they belonged to a person aged between 16 and 22, too old to be any of those five missing Sauter children.
It wasn't the oldest one, 14?
Mm-hmm. Yep, the ones in the attic were between five and 14. So this finding led to the terrifying suggestion that the fill dirt that George used for the bulldozing may have come from a nearby cemetery, meaning the remains were possibly planted by conspirators to confuse the search.
See that.
So this single discovery proved the children were not ever in that house when that fire burned. As a final poignant act of defiance, Jenny refused to let the site become just a normal plot of land. She created a yearly ritual. Every spring, Jenny would plant flowers and vegetables on the basement sill. But she would come to notice that the area remained barren, a patch of land that never seemed to thrive. And this reinforced her conviction that the children weren't there. Because had they been there, and unfortunately then been turned to ash, the land would have thrived.
Yeah.
Things would have grown there. Because it kind of acts like a fertilizer. So the evidence in this case, at least to me anyway, overwhelmingly supports the arson and kidnapping theory. The crime was kidnapping, followed by an arson as a cover-up. But openly, there are three major motives in this crime. These are led by the mafia or the fascist retaliation theory. The sophistication of the attack, so the cut lines, the disabled trucks, the proven incendiary device, suggest an organized group. In the 1940s, the line between fascist political sympathizers and the local Italian-American organized crime fighters often blurred, giving the perpetrators the motive, which was Mussolini revenge, and the professional means, which was the sabotage and the clean removal, in order to execute the crime without leaving a trace. This is fueled by the local man tied to the dark sedan sighting. He was rumored to be Filippo E. Valentini, a specific individual with ties to Georgia's political feud. So while these speculative sightings, so that dark sedan, the bus driver, provide the chaotic imagery of an escape, they remain optical guesses tied to local fear. So it's not any proof for any of that.
No, now, but it's a good theory.
Oh, yeah. So now to move beyond the chaos of the fire and the confusion of the witnesses, we must return to the three core calculated motives that underpin the entire operation. So these motives shift the focus from who was driving the getaway car to who had the deepest, most personal reason to orchestrate this entire disastrous act of sabotage. So these are the two other motives, the local debt or feud theory and the dark speculation of the political informant and deep cover theory. So first, we're going to detail the biggest theory that's out there, the insurance lapse and sabotage theory. The final twist regarding the insurance is crucial to this. So while the local community, led by the insurance salesman who threatened George, quickly rushed the investigation to a close, George's own actions undercut any theory that he set the fire for money. Because that was a huge thing going around. Oh, George did it. He killed his kids. Set his house on fire for insurance money. George had allowed his fire home insurance to lapse right before the fire. This eliminates any possibility for insurance fraud because there was no insurance to claim.
Right.
But it makes the involvement of the insurance salesman who would have known the lapse was imminent or just occurred highly suspicious.
There's a little jerk.
Mm-hmm. He knew that they didn't have fire insurance. He was also part of the coroner's jury, which labeled
it suspicious because he shouldn't have been because it had been in conflict of interest.
Right. And they're the ones that said it was faulty wiring when it wasn't. It's clearly not faulty wiring because the fire started outside, not inside. Yep. So the lapse reinforces the possibility that the salesman, acting on his own personal malice or as a part of a local feud, intended the fire to be an act of pure personal revenge, destroying George's property and reputation without any prospect of financial gain or official legal involvement. So this brings us to a more immediate and local motive, the local debt or feud theory. So this one suggests that the crime was orchestrated by an immediate local adversary whose motive was personal malice, revenge, or financial leverage, not political ideology.
I think they paid somebody to do it.
So like a business rival, basically.
Yeah.
So George Sauter was a successful business owner, but was known to be a proud, outspoken man who often clashed with the local Italian-American community and other residents. He spoke out publicly against Mussolini and fascism, which created significant tension within his largely immigrant neighborhood. Furthermore, George was deeply involved in local land and transport deals where grudges over debt, payment, or contract betrayal are common and often handled outside of the law. A persistent theory involves a debt collector or local gang enforcer with whom George had a serious and violent altercation with just months before the fire. So this one says that the fire was never intended for murder, but was meant as a terrifying warning shot, destroying his property and possibly his children to ensure compliance with a debt that he owed. The abductor, according to this theory, may have simply realized the fire had gotten out of control, making the kidnapping of the surviving children an unplanned escalation to save them or to use them as leverage. The evidence that supports this includes the insurance salesman who served as the jury foreman, showing clear personal malice and procedural control over that investigation. Furthermore, the deliberate act of taking the 20-foot ladder and tossing it into a 70-foot embankment is a high-effort personal obstruction, typical of someone intimately familiar with the Stoddard property and focused on ensuring no one could be rescued. Also,
but if it was the debt collector, if he killed George, he ain't gonna get his money.
Right. But they didn't sleep upstairs.
But they didn't know that.
They could have. If it was someone that, like, he owed money to that knew the home, or if the insurance salesman was in on it, the insurance salesman would know the layout of the house.
Not necessarily.
Well, he would know where the bedroom's at, things like that. Back in those days, anyway, not in today's world. One of those. So also, the reported sightings of a dark sedan driven by a rumored local debt collector near the home supports the idea that the perpetrator was local and tied to George's disputes. However, the evidence that challenges this theory is significant. A local debt collector or insurance salesman likely lacked the technical expertise required to cut the phone line 15 feet in the air.
See, that's what blows my mind, is there had been somebody that knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because not just little Joe Schmo is going to climb up a telephone pole.
Right.
That's what.
But not only that, they had to be able to disable two massive cold trucks simultaneously.
Right. And George's truck.
Yeah, those were the cold trucks.
His personal truck.
That
was
John.
His personal work.
That was John.
Well,
and they all worked the day before. So all of this would have been done in the middle of the night right before the fire.
And it just...
this sophistication points to a wider conspiracy or professional operative.
Somebody knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Also, you have the use of the military-grade incendiary device. The pipe bomb that George found is overkill for a simple debt warning.
Right. That's why I don't think it was debt.
I don't think so either. The local feud or insurance revenge would typically use like gas or some kind of readily available accelerant, not specialized
compounds.
They'd
use like a Molotov cocktail or something like that.
Right. They're not going to use specialized compounds that melt steel.
No.
Especially not for a house that's made of wood.
They wanted that done.
They wanted it.
Short and
done
sweet.
Done and over with fast.
Short and sweet.
Finally, when George hired a PI to follow the 1978 Lewis photo lead, which I have not gotten into, the investigator vanished without a trace. If the threat was merely a local debt, this kind of high-level intimidation of a private investigator would be disproportionate and more indicative of organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the local evidence points strongly to a local perpetrator, but the means of the crime suggests the local person either had access to professional help or was an exceptionally specialized individual, knowing how to do 5 million different things. So now moving on to the final and darkest motive, the political informant and deep cover theory. This theory says that the crime was orchestrated by an organized external entity whose motives was to silence George due to his anti-Mussolini activism. This theory stems from George's past. He was a successful Italian immigrant, fiercely anti-fascist, and carried large amounts of cash. This raises speculation that George was not just an immigrant, but a political operative or informer sent to the U.S. to monitor or disrupt fascist activity among the American Italian immigrant communities during World War II. This motive suggests the children were taken by a deep cover squad as leverage. So the children were not killed in the fire, according to this, but instead were taken and, quote, adopted into new identities to silence George, neutralize him as an informant, or punish him for breaking ranks with a powerful group.
Hey, now that makes sense.
What do you mean?
It's not clicking in my brain.
So this one is saying that basically George was an informant, the Italian government, right? He came to the U.S. He was 13 when he came to the U.S., but he was an Italian informant for the government, okay? Because he always had large cash. He was a very successful immigrant, all of those things. And so the children were taken in order to silence him. So that way he wasn't going and telling the government anything because they were anti-Mussolini. And the house fire was just a cover-up. It was a distraction, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So this would explain the professionalism required for the flawless abductions and the sudden complete cessation of clues. The evidence that supports this is actually pretty strong. So you have the cup, phone wire, the disabled vehicles, the military-grade incendiary device. All of this is a perfect fit for a professional operation pointing towards specialized sabotage tradecraft. So even if he wasn't an informant, personally, this was a professional job.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody was after him.
Yeah.
They wanted to teach him a lesson or something. No one single person can do all of this.
No, not at the same time. It had to have been a group.
Yeah, and they all
knew
what they were doing.
Plus get the children out of there at the same time.
Right.
So,
furthermore, the clean, complete vanishing of the children, like you just said, which is backed by the Smithsonian's findings of no remains, strongly suggests the children were extracted alive, which is often the method of choice for organized intelligence groups seeking leverage or control over an operative.
Yeah.
So, this theory is saying, basically, he was sent to the U.S. as an informant. And it's either he's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, or those that are for Mussolini doesn't like the fact that he's here trying to keep the Italian immigrants quiet.
Yeah.
And so they all banded together and took his children in order to control him and keep him quiet.
Didn't work out well, did it?
And that they didn't kill the children. Instead, they forced the children into different identities and, quote unquote, adopted them out.
I can see that.
That's what this theory is saying. However, there are several facts that challenge this. So if the goal was deep cover silence and George was a crucial informant, then the operation was inexcusably sloppy. Leaving a military incendiary on the roof, allowing the salesman to quickly close the case, and sending a photograph 17 years later are amateur mistakes for a professional intelligence agency. So there's things that support these theories, but there's also things that dismantled. Yeah. So, okay. Also, the fire chief burying a piece of beef liver and calling it a heart is an act of local panicked incompetence or a cover up, not sophisticated political maneuvering.
That's a cover up.
Finally,
he ain't got the
right.
he ain't got the brains that God gave a gnat.
Right. So finally, the FBI's initial reluctant involvement and J. Edgar Hoover's ultimate decision to declare it a local matter suggests the federal government found no credible national security threat warranting a full investigation. So basically, the FBI saying, "No, we're good.
We're busy. Don't bother me."
Dismantles that Italian informant theory. Because if that was the case, the FBI would have gotten involved.
Yeah, but see, back in those days, the FBI was still in its infancy.
Well, yeah, but even J. Edgar Hoover, he's like, no, this isn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's treason. He was an American citizen. That's treason.
Yeah, there you go. I hadn't done that. Actually, the Treasury Department was one of that.
Right. And they found no reason to get involved. Because they did review it. But they're like, no, we're good. Had they found anything to point to that, they would have went after him.
Oh, yeah.
So in the end, while this theory perfectly explains the sophisticated means of the sabotage and the successful vanishing of the kids, the case's immediate mishandling by local authorities and the FBI's disinterest suggest that the professional element was limited to only the kidnapping and arson phase. The political motive was perhaps locally driven rather than orchestrated by a large functioning deep cover government agency. Now, through all of this, hope was kept alive by multiple alleged sightings, including the ultimate ray of hope in 1978. 17 years after, I've mentioned this a couple times. 17 years after the fire, the Sauter family received a shocking piece of mail. Envelope postmarked from Central City, Kentucky, containing a photograph. The black and white image was a picture of a young man in his mid-20s with dark, intense eyes and a distinct, mature version of the features of the youngest missing son, Louis Sauter. On the back of the photo, a cryptic handwritten note was scrawled, quote, "Louis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, I little boys. A90133.
What was that date again?
I'm not sure what the numbers and the letter is. It's A90133. I'm not sure what those are. 33.
That could be a birthday. September 1st.
Yeah.
1933.
I didn't think about that. What would the A be, though?
What are the children's names?
This was Lewis.
Maybe his middle name? Because they didn't.
Because it says Lewis Sauter. I love brother Frankie. L-I-L, boys. And then the letter A, 90133.
Like I said, that could be a birthday. That could have been Lewis's birthday.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. Yeah, it's weird. So this photo is the single most powerful piece of evidence that debunks the core official conclusion of accidental death. If this photo was of Lewis, it irrefutably proves that the 1945 death certificate, the jury foreman, which tenders with the insurance salesman and the fire chief Morris, were wrong or even complicit in declaring the children dead from faulty wiring, which caused the house fire. So if that's Lewis in the photo, in his mid-20s.
That'd be about right.
Their entire whole ordeal saying how they died.
If he was born in 33, and that picture came out what?
It was mailed to them in 1968.
He'd have been like 35.
But when was the photo taken?
Yeah, that's true.
That's when they received it in the mail. So furthermore, the cryptic note hints that Lewis remembers his family and was perhaps in contact with his sibling, suggesting the children were all potentially living under new identities. Now, George Sauter was convinced this photo was Lewis, and he immediately hired a private investigator to travel to Central City, Kentucky, to track down the source of this. But the investigator vanished without a trace, abandoning the jobs and never contacting the Sauters again.
Mm-hmm.
So he just took their money and dipped the fuck out.
Not necessarily.
So despite this setback, the family doubled down on their beliefs.
Well, I don't blame him. I'd want answers too.
Right, exactly. And then all of a sudden hear this photo come.
Yeah, I would want answers too.
So they had a new massive billboard erected on Route 16 in Fayetteville. This one had the original children's photos and the photo of the young man from Central City offering a new reward for information.
Wow.
This development, where a missing child appears to offer a direct physical clue, reinforced the family's convictions that the children were alive and became the central agonizing focus of the parents' final years. Sadly, though, the Sauter parents would die without ever knowing the truth. Their enduring trauma is formally recognized as ambiguous loss. This is a psychological phenomenon where there is no closure because the loved ones are physically missing, but psychologically present. This is a specific type of trauma where grief is frozen, denying the survivors the necessary rituals like a funeral, a grave, or a legal acknowledgement of death that typically allow the healing process to begin. So ambiguous loss basically is you never get to grieve. There is no chance for that because you don't even know what happened. So physically, that person is missing, but psychologically, in your head, they're still there.
Yeah.
Because it's where are they? What happened to them? You can't grieve.
There's no closure.
Right. You can't grieve if you don't know if they're actually dead.
Right.
As a parent, you don't want to believe that your child is dead. You believe that they're just missing. And that's what the Sauter parents went through for the rest of their lives.
That's shame.
For the Sauters, the very act of not knowing whether their children were dead or alive created that perpetual state of psychological limbo. Their dedication to the billboard and the memorial was not just hope. It was a way of coping with that ambiguous loss, forcing the missing children into a tangible external reality so they would not be entirely consumed by internal uncertainty. Now, in order to symbolize her perpetual mourning, Jenny Sauter reportedly wore black clothing every day from the time of the fire until her own death in 1989. So for the rest of her life, she wore nothing but black. Crucially, the ultimate failure of this investigation must be viewed through the lens of post-war West Virginia society. Okay? We talk a lot of shit about how investigators and all of that, they just screw everything up. Okay? But we do have to remember the time. Okay? Because it's the 40s.
It's screwed up now. What are you talking about?
I know. It was the 40s, just after the war. We've kind of got to think about that. George Sauter, though successful, he was an outspoken, wealthy Sardinian immigrant in an insular community. His political views and his foreign background meant that when he clashed with local establishment figures, he lacked that social capital and inherent trust needed to compel an honest investigation. So basically, it was your Sardinian man. Whether you're not from here, you're an immigrant. You don't deserve a full, true investigation. In my opinion, that's ultimately what it came down to. You're an immigrant. You're not American, even though he was.
Right.
Right. But you're an immigrant, so you don't deserve a full, honest investigation.
Yeah, they just kind of brushed them off.
Right. In my opinion, that's basically what it boiled down to. Even though all of his children were American-born citizens. The children weren't immigrants.
No, the children, they were from immigration descent.
Right.
But they were American.
Right.
Even
immigrants, obviously.
They were U.S. citizens.
Yes. All deserve better.
Oh, yeah.
Than what they got here.
Oh, yeah.
American-born, immigrant.
Whatever,
visiting,
human being.
Whatever, all deserve the same level of investigative tactics. Everyone. But I feel like in this case, that's what it was. they looked at him, oh, you're an immigrant. Even though your children are born American citizens, it doesn't matter.
Right.
We're gonna close this up, put a bow on it real quick.
Yep.
I feel like that's what happened here. So this systematic isolation explains why the local authorities were so determined to rush the case to a close.
I mean, it makes sense. It right. really does.
They treated the Sauters justified suspicions as mere immigrant paranoia.
No.
No. Because there's a lot of things here that support their belief that their children didn't die in that fire.
Oh, why now?
The case today remains officially unsolved. And in response, the surviving Sauters eventually tore down the remaining structure of that rebuilt house. Because eventually the house was rebuilt, turning the original site into a completely enclosed concrete slab memorial for their missing sibling, marking the spot where their long, cold Christmas Eve tragedy began. The legacy of the Sauter children endures not because it was solved, but because it so profoundly challenged the simple narrative of tragedy. This case has been widely cited as evidence that authorities are often too quick to close a case.
And that's true even to this day.
Mm-hmm. Creating an enduring piece of American folklore that reminds us that sometimes the mystery is not in who committed the crime, but in the institutional failure to stop it from becoming one. Today, the memorial on Route 16 is a concrete slab with a tall sign displaying the children's faces and acts as a permanent silent vigil. This continuous maintenance that comes with this giant memorial is an act of psychological necessity, channeling the survivor's grief into a physical, visible monument that prevents them from accepting the official conclusion and allows the children's psychological presence to endure. Sylvia Sauter, who was only 2 years old when she escaped the blaze, spent her entire life as the primary caretaker of the memorial and the most outspoken voice fighting for the truth, carrying the torch for her missing siblings until her own death in 2021.
Oh, dang.
So she lived a long life, and she was only two.
Yeah, she was the baby.
Mm-hmm. Her unwavering belief in her siblings' survival is the final persistent thread of hope tying the case from then to present day. And as we finish the story of the Sauter children, we are left with a charred foundation of facts and 8 theories total.
Yeah.
None of which can provide a definitive answer. All we do know is that the 5 children never emerged from that attic. And to this day, the Sauter family refuses to believe that they ever truly died. And for now, that is the case of the missing Sauter children.
Dang, that breaks my heart. It really does.
Personally, I think they were taken from the attic. And I think the fire was set to, not as a distraction because they were asleep, but I think the fire was set to make it appear as though they died.
Yeah.
And I think they were taken because locally, George was a problem.
To teach you the lesson.
To get him to shut up about Mussolini. To be quiet about his anti-fascism. I think that's what it was. I think that's why they were taken. That's why the house was set on fire. But I don't think they intended to take the little ones. They intended to take the older children. Not knowing the older children had traded bedrooms. But by the time they started everything, it was too late. They couldn't back out.
So they had to take the older children.
Yep. So they took the younger ones because we've already gone this far.
They didn't take. They took the older ones or the middle ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I said younger, but it was the middle one. Because they were 5 to 14.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. That's what I think it was. And
it's
then
just
that
all the way around.
I think that. That this are, I think those ones that are missing, I think they went on to live full lives. That's what I think. Yep, that's what I think.
It's just heartbreaking.
Maybe one day somebody will do an ancestry test and find out that they're descendants of those missing Sauter children. And then maybe we'll have an answer.
Who knows?
At least we'll know that I live a full life, you know? Yep.
Oh, wait, I came up with you.
Now, next week, we are exchanging the cold ashes and dark Appalachian nights of West Virginia for the open, freezing skies of the Pacific Northwest in 1971. We'll track the only man in American history to pull off a successful and baffling skyjacking. He walked onto the plane in a suit, ordered a bourbon, and demanded a king's ransom and four parachutes. He got what he wanted and then vanished at 10,000 feet.
I know what you mean.
Launching himself into a dark, rainy wilderness. The FBI spent years tracking down every lead, every possible witness, every drop of parachute silk, only to be left with questions. Was he a master criminal, a daredevil, or did he just become another unsolved body on a muddy riverbank? Join us as we try to decode the ultimate disappearing act and figure out, where did the money go? Did this man ever land? And did he survived that drop. Now, as we head into the last few days before Christmas, we want to wish you and yours a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays from all of us here. And that's all I got. You got anything else?
I just hope everybody has a safe and special Christmas.
Yep.
Spend it with family, good friends, and lots of food.
All right. With that, guys, we hope you keep listening. And remember to
watch out for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.